Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the passion, the craving that people had for spices in Europe during the Middle Ages. And our guest for the program is Paul Friedman. He's interested in a number of things. He specializes in medieval social history, in the trade in luxury products, and also the history of cuisine. And he's the author of a recently published book that's titled Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination. It's published by the Yale University Press. And in it, he observes that in the cooking of the Middle Ages, spices were everywhere. For example, in European cookbooks of the time, spices appear in 75% of the recipes. English cookbooks of the time, they call for spices in 90% of their recipes. And in addition to using spices in cooking, spices were also taken as medicines. They were burned as incense. They were distilled into perfumes. So in this part of Focus, we'll be talking a bit about the first great European luxury consumer item as we talk with Paul Friedman about his book, Out of the East. Questions certainly are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of people just is that they try to keep their questions brief, but otherwise, certainly, you're welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, you can give us a call and join in on the conversation. Professor Friedman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm glad to be with you, David.
The spices that we're talking about, some of these things are things that are used and we would recognize today. Some of the big ones include things like ginger and cinnamon and nutmeg and clove, black pepper particularly. There also, though, were a wide range of things that today either people wouldn't recognize, or if they've heard of frankincense and myrrh, they probably aren't exactly sure what those things are, but they've heard of them. Give us a sense of the range of things that we're talking about here.
Well, in the handbooks for merchants that were drawn up in the Middle Ages, they list as many as 280 products as spices. And what they tend to mean is something that is aromatic, that has a scent, that is imported from far away, and so not grown in Europe. And that's very expensive. Small amounts are very valuable. So this would include perfume and incense substances like frankincense or musk, which comes from a particular kind of deer, or ambergris, a very fragrant product of sperm whales, as well as the edible spices that we're more familiar with.
And if you were going to buy some of this stuff, it wouldn't matter whether you were going to cook with it or whether you were thinking about its medicinal properties, or that you just thought that it smelled very nice, chances are you might go to one of two different kinds of people. They would deal with all of these sorts of things.
That's right. I mean, there's something of a difference between an apothecary, a druggist who carries spices and herbs and other products that are intended for medicinal use, and someone who is selling more edible products, but usually the overlap is so great that, for example, in medieval London, there's a guild of spicers, as they're called, but then they become the apothecaries, and then they sort of merge into a guild called the grocers. So, yes, spices are very versatile, and you might sprinkle ambergris on your eggs and also burn it for a room freshener and carry it around to ward off disease.
Yeah. And obviously here we are talking about something that would not have been available to everyone because these things were expensive. But for those people who did use them, particularly I'm interested, I guess, in the culinary use. It wasn't just that they liked a little bit of spice. They liked a lot of spice. And not only did the recipes apparently call for significant amounts of things, but they liked to combine them. So it wasn't just that they put a little bit of cinnamon in something or they put a little bit of nutmeg in something. They put, it could be several different spices would be combined in one dish.
That's right. It's not like, you know, we might put cinnamon on French toast, but we wouldn't put cinnamon and cloves and ginger and galangal and saffron. It's a little bit similar to the cuisine of India or the Middle East, where you have fairly substantial amounts of spices, but even more significantly, the spices are used as combinations. So, you know, what we call curry powder or garam masala are combinations of spices. And in the Middle East, they have these combinations of as many as 10 ingredients at a time to give you a kind of palette or a spectrum of flavors.
Yeah. So the kind of use of mixtures of spices, perhaps sometimes very long ingredient lists that you can see, for example, in cooking in India, that is still common today. That's not so common in Europe, but there would have been a time that, at least for people who were affluent, that kind of cooking would be common.
That's right. And so if you were to go to medieval Europe, the closest parallel, it's not all that close in certain respects because of the huge amounts of meat, for example, that medieval cuisine involves, but the closest parallel would be the food of India today.
You pose this question, well, why? Why was it that people were so consumed with spices? And there are a number of reasons, but just here early on, I wanted to dispense with what I think a lot of people would come up with as the conventional explanation. They would say, well, you know, the thing about the Middle Ages was they didn't have refrigerators, they didn't have good ways to preserve things, so people were eating a lot of food that was past its prime, and what they were doing with all these spices was covering up for the fact that they were eating stuff that was bad. And you say, no, that's what people think, but that's not true.
It's an appealing explanation, but it's not true, in part because, although you're right, there was no refrigeration, there are other ways of preserving meat that are much more effective and, even more importantly, much cheaper than adding extremely expensive spices. Things like smoking, salting, drying, or pickling will preserve meat quite effectively. Now, you may add spices, to the pickling ingredients, but spices alone won't do that much to preserve meat compared to these other things. And the spices are so expensive that to use them to preserve meat would be something like slicing truffles or some insanely expensive ingredient onto, a fast food cheeseburger in order to give it a little lift. The decoration is so much more expensive than the main inexpensive ingredient that it doesn't really make sense.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a sense, I'm sure that people do have the idea that these things were, because they were rare and because they had to be imported from a long way away, they were expensive. When you say that, is there any way that you can translate that into contemporary terms so that you could say something like, well, if you wanted to buy some cinnamon or you wanted to buy cloves or you wanted to buy black pepper, what it would have cost you?
Well, it's hard because the currency is too distant to make the transition, and also because people spent a greater proportion of their money on food, even rich people. Food was a kind of way of displaying affluence that was extremely important in a world that didn't have all the machines that we do or some of the technology that we do that we use to display wealth. Spices are still expensive today. But to get an idea of the proportion, for things like wedding celebrations, coronation banquets, the enthronement of bishops, where you have a banquet for hundreds or in some cases even thousands of guests, about a third of the expense was spices. So that the expense is very great. A pound of pepper, which is the least expensive spice, would be something on the order of a week's wages for a skilled worker.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Paul Friedman. He's a professor of history at Yale, and he is interested in, among other things, in the history of cuisine and certainly very much in the Middle Ages, and he's authored a book that looks at spices and people's interest in them, what they did with them, why they were so important. His book is titled Out of the East, Spices in the Medieval Imagination. It's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, in addition, perhaps, to people liking the way these things tasted and what they did to their food, I think you touched on one of the big reasons that spices were popular, again, with people who could afford them, and that it was a way of demonstrating your wealth.
That's right. And the people who could afford them would not be just the highest nobility or the royal courts, although they kind of set the pace of fashion. It becomes an item that defines upper-class taste. And so you would have to serve meals that were heavily spiced to guests. And, you know, if you didn't, it would be like serving frozen wax beans or Spam. You know, you really can't do that above a certain pretty basic level of income.
Was salt considered to be a spice?
No, salt was considered to be a bulk commodity, more like wheat or honey or timber. It is necessary. It is very valuable in a kind of bulk sense because it doesn't exist everywhere, and people have to have it in order to survive. But spices were a luxury in the sense that people didn't have to have it, unlike salt. But it was a luxury the way, say, certain kinds of coffee are luxuries. They're very widely spread. A lot of people had the ability to afford a small but significant amount, at least of things like pepper and ginger, so that even in small provincial areas, the affluent people of that area, by which I would mean, say, the top 20% would cook a quite a highly spiced cuisine as
yeah.
well.
It's interesting. I think in the book you'd comment on the fact that pepper was one of those things that, of the spices, it was one of those things that perhaps was the most affordable or became the most affordable. And as it became so that more and more people could have pepper, the very richest people started to look down on pepper as if that, well, pepper is not that big of a thing. After all, anyone could have pepper.
That's right. There's a kind of hierarchy of spices, so that the most prestigious edible spices were things like cloves and nutmeg, which come from even farther away, modern Indonesia, than pepper, most of which was from India, did, and which could cost up to 15 or 20 times the price of pepper.
Yeah. I guess at one time, or maybe it was for a long time, all of the cloves and the nutmeg in the world came from this very small area in what is now part of Indonesia.
They came from tiny islands in the eastern part of Indonesia, really until modern times, until almost the end of the 18th century. And it's interesting that the island of Manhattan was traded by the Dutch to the British in return for the British giving them one of these nutmeg islands. In the late 17th century, when New Amsterdam became New York, these two islands were of more or less equivalent value. And obviously things have changed in the last 300 years.
Mm-hmm. Could you give an example of a medieval recipe to give people a sense of what the food would have been like, what we're talking about, what spices were used, how much spices were used?
Yes. Now, the recipes usually don't give amounts. They often sort of say enough or a sufficiency or a lot. But, for example, in the book I mention some recipes for wine, spiced wine, but also one for haddock, a fish in a sauce called gyve, G-Y-V-E. And it says, take a haddock and cut off the head and roast the body until it's roasted enough. These are not, you know, directions for amateurs. You should just judge this. And then seep bread in a broth of salmon or other good fish and cut up parsley, and then a great deal of red wine, whole cloves, mace, powdered pepper, and a great deal of cinnamon. Here again, the multi-ingredient, multi-spice mixture and somewhat imprecise quantities. The liver of the haddock you should chop with the spices, and the stomach. boil them, take out the pouch that you've made of these spices and the liver, and cut these smaller, put them into a pot, add raisins, saffron, an ingredient that they call Saunders, which is red sandalwood, to give it a kind of color. With the saffron, it would come out bright orange and red, and salt. And then you boil this. Notice that there are all sorts of different steps. They really love highly processed cooking. And season it up with powder of ginger and verjuice, so more spices, and verjuice, which is a kind of grape juice made from unripe grapes. So it's like in between vinegar and grape juice. Then skin the haddock, lay it on a charger. Actually, in the medieval recipes, they always call the dishes somewhat kind of disconcertingly him. So the haddock is lay him on a charger, on a serving dish. Pour the sauce around him and serve it forth.
Hmm. And apparently they like to, the sauces are rather thin. They seem to like sweet and sour tastes, so they certainly did cook with vinegar. And that some of the recipes did indeed incorporate dried fruit. And I suppose there were things where spices were really mixed in with ground up meat and so forth. But a lot of these were highly spiced sauces that were then put on roast meat, because for wealthy people, the diet was very protein heavy.
Very protein heavy. They seemed to despise vegetables and dairy products. And so if a peasant wasn't actually faced with starvation, let's say a moderately well-off peasant in a good harvest year, the peasant would be eating certainly a more balanced diet than the aristocracy.
And actually, I think it's probably true that by what we understand today to be what it constitutes a healthy diet, or what's recommended to be a healthy diet, is that to the extent that they could get food, if they had food, that the kind of food that poorer people would be eating would actually be better for them probably than the food that very wealthy people were eating.
Well, below a certain level, and the poverty rate would be quite high, of course, in the Middle Ages, then people are starting to eat way too much just very basic grain, and often the ingredients are very poor in quality and also insufficient in quantity. But at the, I think, the middle level, the sort of the 50% below the top 10% would be eating a more balanced diet than the top 10%, for sure.
They had some sort of odd ideas about food and what it did to the body. I think it's interesting that they would think that that dried fruits would be fine, but they didn't think that eating fresh fruit was particularly good for you.
Yeah, it looks as if they did eat fresh fruit anyway, but the medical advice of the time emphasized the theory of humors, that we have a kind of equilibrium among four different kinds of fluids in our body, and that equilibrium is very tricky to maintain. And so something like fruit, which is, according to humoral theory, wet and sort of heavy, then is not digested properly and is going to rot in the stomach. They're very concerned with food putrefying within. And so spices are good for things like meat and fish that are cold and wet and that need something hot and dry, like spices, to kind of process, to allow the body to process them properly.
Yeah, they had this interesting way of thinking about different foods and their qualities and classifying them in different particular ways, the way they classified people according to their what they saw as being their basic personality types. And I suppose then they're, in a way, they also thought that people, depending on what kind of person you were, it would be good for you to either eat certain kinds of things or to avoid certain kinds of things.
Yes, it's a little like astrology. You have to have your personal profile drawn up in order for the doctor to understand how to make recommendations for your diet. So you may be a person of what's called sanguine temperament, a word that we still use to mean kind of optimistic, but the origin of the word is the Latin word for blood, sanguinis. And this meant that of the humor that predominates in your body is blood, and that gives you a certain personality, or as it's called, temperament. And it also means there are certain dishes you should stay away from and certain dishes you should emphasize, certain spice combinations that are better for you. But all of this is the desire for equilibrium. Nobody is born neutral. Everybody has a kind of humoral profile.
We were talking about the fact that there were a wide, when people talked about spices, they were talking about a wide range of substances, some of which were used in cooking, others that were used as had medicinal applications, other things that were used for making various kinds of scents. One thing that I found interesting was that sugar at one time was considered a spice.
Yeah, sugar is a little tricky because it's not, strictly speaking, aromatic. But it was used in a way that's different from now, where it's a kind of basic commodity. And in the Middle Ages, they liked to mix up sweet and savory. As you said, they liked sweet and sour tastes. But they also, as you see with the adding the dried fruit to fish, didn't mind, as we tend to, having sweet ingredients in a dish that is salty and savory, so that they don't have dessert the way we do. They don't have a sweet course. And so sugar is added to many spices, or is itself really a kind of spice, and it's used across the menu like spices are, so that one of the most alien things about medieval food from the modern point of view is having sugar with fish, or sugar with meat, or the topping for pasta in Italy, really up until about 1800, was typically sugar and cinnamon.
I guess I had heard that, and also had heard that there were some places in Italy where perhaps not that long ago, maybe still, that in particular places they put an unusual ingredient into their red sauce for pasta. And in some places people put cinnamon in their tomato sauce, and that also, though, goes back to this idea that it was a way of showing that you were wealthy, that you could afford to have cinnamon and put it into your tomato sauce or anything else that you were going to put it
in. That's probably true. Of course, I guess it should be emphasized that some of this, really the most important part, is taste. People liked the way these things tasted. You can only get so far on prestige. If people don't like the way something tastes, all the prestige in the world is not really going to induce them to try it. Or if it does, it'll just be a very temporary fashion. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about something that went on for hundreds and hundreds of years. So that clearly they liked the way this tasted. And the Italian recipes still call for nutmeg in a lot of interesting mm-hmm. places, like bechamel sauce.
Our guest is, in this part of Focus 580, is Paul Friedman. He's the Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale. He's interested in life in the Middle Ages, in the history of food, and he's written a book that looks at the craving for spices in the Middle Ages, why they were important, what people used them for. It's a very interesting book. The title is Out of the East, Spices in the Medieval Imagination. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have somebody here who'd like to join in, and they're in Hoopston. So this is our toll free line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show once again. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick observations for your guest. He caught me when he said about the salty and the sweet taste and all that. I just read recently, and you have to forgive me because I don't remember, I want to say New York, but there's a lady who is doing a landslide business with chocolate, pieces of chocolate, and she has sprinkled sea salt on top of them and supposedly enhances the flavor of the chocolate with the salt, and it's a big to-do because this is a big deal that no one's ever heard of, so I appreciate the comments of your guest. What I was going to say was just going back in history, I was raised Polish, and my mother used to give us a soup. It was called czarnina, and it was made out of the, not to be gross, but it was made out of the blood of a duck. And I remember eating this with noodles, raisins, prunes, sugar, and cream. And I tell my kids this, and of course they look like I got lobsters coming out of my heads. But it was a complete, it was quite a combination of tastes and flavors. I remember it being quite good. Maybe it's something to do with my age. I did want to comment about the combination of flavors, and I thought it was interesting what your guest said. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
That's right. And this is very interesting. I guess what the two remarks point to is both the survival of old ideas and what is now the cutting edge of cuisine. The chocolates, there are many places now that have artisanal chocolates that have curry flavor or curried centers or hot peppers. Actually, a student of mine in a class I'm teaching, an undergraduate class on the history of food, has a blog on chocolates, and she gave me some chocolate with bacon flavor. So indeed, now there's a lot of experimentation with combining sweet and savory. There are always some dishes, of course, that have done this anyway. Americans, in fact, like sweet and sour. For example, if you compare what we eat by way of Chinese food by what's commonly available in China, we love things like General Tso's chicken or sweet and sour pork or Chinese food with little pieces of pineapple around it, to take the sort of 1950s version. So some of these combinations have always existed. Polish food or Eastern European food have some survivals, or to put it more positively, weren't quite taken over by the shifts in French cuisine that, beginning in the 17th century, tended to reduce the amount of spice in European cooking and also banish sugar to the dessert and little treat category.
Yeah. All right. I appreciate the comments of the call. I also have tried that candy, that chocolate with bacon in it. It seemed to me a strange idea at the time. This is, I know there's one chocolatier that's been very successful, Vosges. Different sorts of interesting things in the chocolate, unconventional ingredients. Many of them do have salt. And there was this one bar that had the bacon in it. It was being sold here locally, and I just walked in and I said, "What's up with this chocolate with the bacon in it?" And they said, "Well, would you like to taste it?" And I said, "Okay." And it was interesting. It was a good chocolate, and it did have that odd sort of bacony finish, left that sort of bacon fat mouthfeel
at the end. And then the question is, are you going to plan to buy it again?
I think not.
Yeah, that was sort of my reaction. On the other hand, I love the curry flavor and wouldn't mind having those many times again. Hot pepper, I'd say, also I like, but I'm kind of feeling my way forward in that.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk with someone here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Forgive me, I tuned in just a little late, so if you've covered the information I'm about to ask about,
sure.
My apologies. But I'm interested in the cost. If you could provide some idea of just how expensive these spices were relative to day's wages for a laborer or something like that. If there was a difference in cost from region to region, and what the particular points were when these costs came down, when sugar switched from being something that was precious to something that was sort of a staple commodity.
Yes, these are questions we just briefly touched on, but there's a fair amount of regional difference in that Venice and Genoa, Barcelona, these Mediterranean ports that tended to be kind of the wholesale location where spices came into Europe, the cost there could be as little as one half of the cost of, say, London or someplace else in Northern Europe. Spices like saffron or incense ingredients or perfume ingredients like ambergris were much more expensive than the kind of basic spices, which would be ginger and pepper in particular. In terms of what a laborer earned, this is kind of hard to say, but we have some clues. For example, a historian at the University of Toronto named John Munro has taken a London craftsman wage of the year 1439, which would be about 8 pence a day. Now, for 1 penny, you could buy a gallon of milk. You could buy a pint of butter or lard. you could buy a quarter of a bushel of coal. But a pound of sugar would cost 16 pence. So a pound of sugar would be 2 days' labor. Pepper would be a little more. A pound of cloves would cost 4.5 days' work. Now, to be sure, then and now, a pound of cloves would go a long way. So this is what might be called, it is very expensive, but it's not completely unaffordable to somebody who was had a steady and reasonably high income.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and to line number four, I think you have somebody here in Champaign on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, hi. Yeah. You mentioned that recipe from the Renaissance or the medieval period, and I always love hearing how they describe things and expecting cooks to be experts. My wife and I have actually done a couple of Renaissance dinners where we looked for some of those old recipes. We found a tremendous book called In Shakespeare's Kitchen. A little later time period, of course, they took some of the references that Shakespeare made in his writings and looked for recipes that related to those foods, and then they translated the recipes to something modern and usable. Are there other books that might do the same kind of thing? I'll go ahead and listen to your answer offline.
Sure. There are a couple of interesting books that both give the original and then suggestions for how to adopt them. There's one called The Medieval Kitchen, and I believe it's a co-authored book. One of the authors is named Odile Redon, R-E-D-O-N. And there's also a book called An Ordinance of Pottage, sort of a ye olde kind of title of a cookbook. And the editor of that is Constance, and translator Constance Hyatt, H-I-E-A-T-T, Constance Hyatt. And she also has another book, and the second one I'm sure has modernized recipes because it's in the title. She has a book called Plain Delight, and again, this is a sort of medieval term, so the plain is spelled P-L-E-Y-N, and delight is spelled D-E-L-I-T. Its subtitle is Medieval Cookery for Modern Cooks. I guess I'd recommend that and the Redon book for ideas of how to adopt things. And what's good about them is that they give you both the original and the suggestions for how to interpret the original.
All right, very good. Let's talk with someone else here in Robinson. This is line four. Hello.
Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. Your guest will find this off target, but I am a genealogist and have occasion to investigate ancestors from medieval England named Culpepper, and no one seems to be able to explain the name. Have you, in your medieval food research, ever come across a name or words from which it might be derived?
That's very interesting. The easy answer is no. I don't have much to offer. It's not an uncommon name now. I don't know of it, but it's got to have something to do with the profession of pepperer, as you certainly know. A lot of names are derived from occupations,
sure. Common
occupations, miller, Fletcher, baker, and so forth. What the cull is, I think could be found out, but pepper as a name also appears, of course, as a soul name. Very interesting question, and I wish I could be a little more better informed on an answer.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
We are moving into perhaps about our last 15 minutes, and I'd like to introduce again the guest, Paul Friedman. He's professor of history at Yale University and is interested, among other things, in life in the Middle Ages. He specializes in medieval social history. He's written about trade and luxury products of the time, also the history of cuisine, and that comes together in his book, Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination. It's published by the Yale University Press. I want to make sure that there are a lot of interesting things in the book that we may not get to, but one thing that I do want to talk about is how and why things changed, because you you know, made the observation that if you think about kind of what Indian cooking is like today, that European cooking in the Middle Ages for the people who had the money to live that way was perhaps, if you're looking for something to compare it to, that would be what it would be. That they liked spices. They liked spices in significant amounts. They liked them all mixed together, these complicated palettes of spices. But that once we get to the end of the period you're talking about, so maybe we're getting into the 1600s, things really changed. And I guess for a couple of reasons, one of them being is that some people found this kind of conspicuous consumption to be immoral, essentially, and condemned it.
Yes, the spices were condemned by religious moralists as an example of absurd priorities, people spending gross quantities of money and boasting about a product that is consumed and just becomes part of a general excrement, and how scandalous this was. But some of it is really a question, again, of taste and of turning away from spices to a different aesthetic. And I guess there are two basic reasons for this change of taste. One is the arrival of products either from the newly discovered world from America, like chocolate, or products that come from Asia but had not been known in medieval Europe, coffee and tea. And then a product that, although not edible, took Europe by storm, and that is tobacco. These things created a kind of new prestige items, and also, unlike spices, they're kind of mood-altering or mood-enhancing. And so spices seemed kind of old-fashioned compared to these relatively new products of the 16th and 17th century.
Yeah.
The other reason, I think, is that the French develop something more like modern sauces that are thicker, more buttery, richer, and based on meat.
Yeah, and there I think it's interesting that it is also an example of the way that tastes can change, that people who were promoting that kind of cooking also were in a way that we kind of do now, is that they're saying you should let the ingredient come through. And they were saying, I want to taste I don't want to taste just this mixture of spices. I don't want to just taste cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. I want to taste what it is that we're cooking here. It's not to say that kind of cookie is not complex, because it can be complex. And yet, in a way, it's sort of it's more straightforward in the sense that it puts the feature on the ingredient and not covering that up, but letting whatever the taste of that is come through.
Yes, and that's a revolutionary event in the history of cuisine in the 17th, the early 18th century. It is an event that repeats itself at various times. So Nouvelle cuisine of the 1970s was based on a rejection of what seemed like the artificial and covering up emphasis on sauces, and a desire to minimize the external flavoring and emphasize the quality of ingredients. A lot of what's happened in recent American cuisine is a rediscovery of ingredients, so that it's better to have absolutely perfect, locally grown, locally sourced ingredients that really taste good, rather than developing all sorts of means of seeing them up. So sometimes the fashion is for artifice, and sometimes the fashion is for nature. In the 17th, 18th century, nature won out, and as you say, David, it's really a question of the original flavor intensifying.
When this chain, whose business it was to import and sell spices?
It certainly hurt the traditional suppliers like Venice and Genoa, or the newer suppliers like Lisbon and Amsterdam. Most of them, however, were able to diversify pretty quickly, so that Amsterdam became a big capital of chocolate and coffee importing, and then you get some new cities that become big coffee importers, or cities like Liverpool, which grows up in this period as a sugar center, and although sugar, like other spices, gets kicked out of main courses, it becomes this colossus that it still is today. The average American consumes an immense amount of sugar, even more than people from England. And in fact, the sugar that we eat now is present in things like salad dressings or barbecue sauces. So yeah, there is this mixture of sweet and savory more than we sometimes like to admit.
Well, there is certainly the if you go back to the cooking of Rome and Greece, people used sweeteners, but I suppose the big thing there would have been honey that they would have used.
Yeah, that's the only thing they have, because sugar really doesn't get introduced until sometime in the Middle Ages.
And
honey's just not as sweet.
And the sugar, when did sugar, though, become really a more of a mass-produced commodity? And how did that, were there in, say in Europe then, did people actually start producing sugar, or was that still something, an item that was an imported item?
Yeah, it's unusual in that, like saffron, it could be grown in Europe, although only in the very Mediterranean islands like Sicily or Majorca. It is cultivated in the New World, and it really gets going in the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. And it gets going in the Caribbean with slavery. Sugar declines in price, but the immense quantities of sugar more than make up from the point of view of the planter or the trader. The career of sugar, though, is related to, or the cause of, the first wave of the enslavement of Africans to cultivate sugar long before cotton became the big crop in further north in the United States.
You know, we were talking earlier about obviously the central question in the book that you explore in different ways is why it is that there was this great craving for spices at this particular period that we're talking about, roughly speaking between the year 1000 and the 1500s, and that you can account for it in part, as we said, that it was a rare and expensive item, and you could demonstrate that you were a wealthy person if you could have it. That also people liked it. They liked the taste, as you said. You know, people aren't really going to eat something if they don't really like it.
Right.
So it tasted good to them, and it was a way of demonstrating that you were wealthy. But that also isn't quite enough. It does touch on health issues, but there also was something here that was very powerful, and that was an almost mystical association that people had with exotic tastes and exotic scents. And I suppose that goes to the matter of where it is these things came from.
Yes, and that's why the book is entitled Out of the East. These are products that are from East Asia or from India or even farther away. In other words, from places that in medieval Europe, they had only the vaguest idea of where these places were. If you look on medieval maps, for example, they often place India right next to the Garden of Eden in the furthest extreme of Eastern Asia. And this is because it was thought to be as close to paradise as you could get, because look at these wonderful products that it produces. So the fact that they came from so far away is both evidence of the prestige of Asia, the mystique of Asia, the idea of the exotic, and also proof of the economic power of the ability of demand to draw to it products from places that the users had no idea where they were.
There, in explaining the explosion of interest in and demand for spices, it seems that sometimes that also the conventional explanations say, well, it has something to do with the Crusades, and it really truly has something to do with the influence of Islamic culture on the culture of Europe, which certainly was important in a lot of ways. You seem to be inclined to say you think, well, that's really not that really what it, when you ask this question, well, where does this come from, that your take seems to be that really wasn't that important.
Well, I don't think that it's the sole explanation. The prestige of Islam is tremendous, even if Islam was, of course, regarded as the religion of infidels. The Muslim world was urban, rich, sophisticated, and so a lot of fashions and things like dress or armor, weaponry, and cuisine came from the Muslim world. You don't necessarily have to like people whose products you are imitating. But having said that, it's not enough of an explanation just to say, oh, well, once the Crusaders tasted cloves, they didn't look back. Mm-hmm. These products seem to have existed in Europe beforehand, and the taste for them was very strong, the mystique, the medicinal use and everything. What the Crusades and with contact with Islam in places like Spain or Sicily accomplished was to make them more available, to increase the volume, so that what previously had been reserved just for the royal courts or the highest members of the church now became widespread enough among an affluent upper class. Upper class, to be sure, but more like 10 to 20% of the population rather than, you know, one or
yeah.
two.
You know, I suppose you wouldn't think that it was a great mystery if people on the other side of the Mediterranean or people who were near to the Middle East would be interested in foods and tastes and things that people in North Africa or in the Middle East were doing.
That's right. And there tended to be, ironically, given the religious divide, more commerce and more cultural contact between the northern European side of the Mediterranean and North Africa and the Middle East, so that the the average Italian merchant would spend a lot of time dealing with or even going to places like Alexandria or Beirut. These were just the rich entrepôts, the rich mercantile centers of the time.
Going back again to this idea that the things that were considered to be spices, this was a wide range of things with different sorts of applications. And again, when you say spices, now people today will think of, well, things that you use in cooking. And that certainly was part of it, that the things we've talked about were very popular, much in demand: ginger, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, black pepper, saffron, a lot of other things like that that we would still recognize and use. But that there were also things that had medicinal applications. And the thing that I'm interested to talk about here, we have a couple of minutes left, is what maybe today we would call aromatherapy, the idea that scents had potential benefits, not just to make you feel better just because they smell nice, but that they actually had positive health benefits.
That's right, that what smells wonderful has an effect not only on your psychology, but on your health. And so aromatherapy, whether you agree with its principles or not, is a kind of way of understanding the medieval overlap between a spice that's edible, a spice that's used as a medicine, a spice that's used as a sort of psychological enhancer of experience or something that helps what we would call wellness. And really, aromatherapy and wellness are ideas. They don't have the name in the Middle Ages, but that is really the medieval idea of what makes spices so great. They're versatile, they're healthful, and they're prestigious as well.
And people believed that it was possible. This is obviously going back to a time when we don't have the modern theory of disease. But they did have the sense that there were things out there in the environment, floating around in the environment, that were problematic, and that that scents could be used and did have this kind of property that they could, in a sense, protect you. They could ward off these sorts of things. And that is, for example, the reason that people carried pomanders. Things that it was not just because we think now, well, it's because they were walking down the street and it didn't smell very good. But it was that probably wasn't the big thing. They actually thought that this was a way to ward off disease.
That's right. And they thought that bad odors caused disease and not merely sort of unhygienic encouragers of disease, but that literally disease spread through miasma or bad air. Malaria takes its name from that idea. And the way to combat that, of course, was by providing your own source of perfumed good air, so that was a way of warding off disease by creating a kind of pleasurable counter effect to these awful smells.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps one last idea, that is the connection between spirituality, spiritual refinement, and scent. No accident that people in church burn incense.
Yeah, or the idea widespread in the Middle Ages that the bodies of saints can be recognized because they, unlike most bodies or long decayed corpses, they exude a fragrance reminiscent of spices, a fragrance of paradise.
Yeah, so that part of the explanation why the wise men come to see the baby Jesus, they bring gold, but they also bring these two other things. These things that people have heard of, maybe not really sure what they are.
Exactly. Two of the three are aromatic products. Gold is the only non-aromatic that they bring.
And these other things, frankincense and myrrh, what were these things used for?
They are resins from plants that are in Arabia and Ethiopia up to the Red Sea area, Somalia as well, and they, when burned on charcoal or in a brazier, like an incense, a censer, produce an extraordinary, unique, instantly recognizable fragrance. And that fragrance is both a symbol of eternity, of sanctity, of a kind of eternal beauty, so that even though this is something that's being consumed as it's being burned, it's supposed to symbolize a kind of the sense of paradise, the sense of heaven, the way that things will be in the world to come.
Well, if folks who are listening would like to explore this subject further, the book to look for is this book that I've mentioned several times. The title is Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination. It's published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Paul Friedman. He's Chester D. Tripp, professor of history at Yale, and among other things, is interested in medieval social history and history of cuisine. Professor Friedman, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Support for this show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. That is it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll take a look at how our species became what it is. We'll talk about the features that separate us from the rest of the animal kingdom, including our big toes and thumbs and our ability to laugh, cry, and kiss. Our guest will be Chip Walter. He is a science writer, and he is the author of Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. He'll join us at 1:06. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat is trading at 10.15 and a quarter, down 39 and three quarters. In Chicago, May wheat 9.76, down 38. July 9.79, down 38 and a half. May corn 5.51, down 4.5. July 5.63 and a quarter, down 4. September 5.66 and three quarters, down 2.25. December 5.66 and a half, down 2. May beans 12.60, down 67 and a quarter. July 12.75, down 67 and a half. August 12.65 and three quarters, down 62 and a quarter. November 11.55 and three quarters. Make that 11.54 and three quarters, down 53 and three quarters. May meal 333.70, down 15.10. May oil 54.98, down 2.50. At the Burke in Chicago, April live cattle 87.82.5, down 80. June 87.85, down 75. April feeder cattle $100.57.5.